Hey, good people. It's your girl, Fredrika McClary Easley, back with another episode of The People Are Blunt, but today is special. Before I get into why it's special, I'm going to do some housekeeping. So, y'all already know, I'm going to say it anyway, but you already know, we're on all the platforms, Amazon Music, Spotify, YouTube, like, subscribe, share, do all of the good things, especially on YouTube. Please make sure you go on and subscribe, comment on the episodes. I actually read them and respond. So you take your time. I will take my time. And I'm going to introduce my guest, talk about why it's special, and then go into the amazing ways or all the ways that you can connect with him. So he is no stranger to The People Are Blunt. Mr. Yaro, he even put the middle name in there. So Yaro Lee Kubrin in the building. Say hey to the people.
Super good to be here with you. Welcome. Thanks for tuning in.
All that good stuff. So look, y'all have seen Yaro's face a number of times. Like I said, he is not a stranger. But he and I wanted to try something out, right? And so we're going to be coming to you all with some installments of we're testing out this name, but we're thinking about what's really good, right? We want to be able to talk about current events, like stuff that's going on in cannabis right now, topics that are trending, at least in our eyesight, right, in our minds, and some of the highlights, right? So first of all, let us know what you think about what's really good. Like, does that ring true to you? If you have a suggestion, then please share that as well. And then to follow us otherwise, Yaro is on IG, X, which is formerly known as Twitter, and LinkedIn as Yaro Kubrin. On LinkedIn specifically, he's Yaro Lee Kubrin, but it's not too many Yaros, like, period. So if you put Yaro in, he's gonna come up for the most part, okay? And then, of course, I'm on IG as at The People Are Blunt. Please like that page as well. Follow. We're trying to get these blue checks. And then on LinkedIn, on YouTube, we are The People Are Blunt. That is under the people's ecosystem. And so, without further ado, let's kick this shit off. So, first of all, I want to tap into, I think, what's on everyone's mind, right? And it has been up for debate for a while now. But here we are, rescheduling, right? The DEA has come out with their rules. The public comment period is open until July 22nd. That document was released. It's like 92 pages. Thankfully, there's a summary at the end. But it actually is like quite an interesting read. So, you know, now, you know, you still have the back and forth that's going on in terms of people saying like, look, this reschedule is not going to be what you thought it was going to be. Big Pharma is about to take over. You know, the MSOs are going to get away with a sweet deal, like all of the tax write-offs they're going to have. What's your take on where we are right now with this whole rescheduling thing?
Well, I'm not patient around change, and I'm not a big advocate for incrementalism. And I know that the first medical program that I'm aware of was almost 30 years ago in California, and that we wouldn't have medical cannabis if it wasn't for gay people dying from AIDS. And so I recognize that the tip of the spear for policy change has been advocacy based on life and death. And the journey that I've gone through, the doors that were kicked down, the assets that were taken, the children that were taken to CPS over the weekend, the friends, the family that was handcuffed, the cases that were fought, the legal fees that were paid, the time that was served. For me, anything that is a step in the right direction, regulated cannabis is full of headaches, and the headaches are still better than cops and robbers. And so, you know, reschedule versus deschedule. I think descheduling probably would have been better. Rescheduling is still a step in my mind in the right direction. And to your point about all the fears about what are likely outcomes as a result, I actually share all of those fears and think every single one of those is very probable. The MSOs will have a head start. Those abilities to deduct under, you know, under 280E are going to boost stocks for those companies that are probably already most resourced and best positioned to take advantage of the changes. And I think about how long it's going to take between that change and a set of comprehensive rules from which to operate because of that change, which unfortunately, if history is the best predictor of the future, is going to be full of a lot of inefficiencies and duplicated mistakes from policies in states where we already know certain things don't work.
Yeah. A lot to unpack there. First of all, and people, if you are not familiar with Yarrow's journey and like his story, then like you need to go back to the first episode, like a year and a half ago, maybe even 2 years that Yarrow and I did, where he laid it all out, right? So all of the asset forfeiture and, you know, just the trauma that he and his family went through, right? So he is definitely speaking from personal experience in terms of having had to engage with our legal system in regards to this plan. I mean, a couple of things that you said, like, I want to kind of unpack, right? Like, the first thing is in terms of these fears, in terms of the multi-state operators, the MSOs, and, you know, big pharma. So in my mind, and not just in my mind, but like the reality is, big pharma is already here, right? Like, big pharma has been at the door knocking and already, you know, with its lobbyists, like, influencing. I think that there's sometimes this idea that we can stop something. I don't really know, like, with the money they have, I don't know if it's even possible to stop big pharma. And that doesn't mean that we don't try. We definitely still move forward with putting guardrails up. But this idea of that even being possible, I don't know that that's true. The second thing, in terms of multi-state operators, I mean, most multi-state operators have full verticals, right? Especially if they're in medical, like, that was usually one of the requirements of being able to get the license. And so they already have some tax breaks or some ways that they can finagle because they have part of their business that's plant touching and part that's not, right? So they've already been receiving some relief, right? Because of being a vertical versus what, you know, mom and pop, small business owners have been able or not been able to do. And so this idea that there's even a lane, and if there is, I would love for someone to paint it, you know, to show me the way, but that there is the possibility that anything would be passed that would restrict them from receiving any additional benefits or being able to do anything in addition, but allow other groups to move forward. Again, that's something that I don't know that is possible, right? And so, you know, it, and just to put it plainly, currently small business owners are in crisis, especially with plant touching 280E, having to pay 70 to 80% in taxes because they can't make normal deductions, right? So they're in crisis. They need this relief so that they can, whether it's being able to have access to other forms of financing, or it's being able to have, to be able to keep more of their own money so they can reinvest it in themselves, right? Which again, changes their leverage because it changes the evaluation of their company. I don't know that they get to do that and have that without these other groups, without, you know, without multi-state operators, without those who are in a different financial position, without them actually receiving any kind of benefit. Like the idea that there could be this either or does not exist.
I mean, Shalene Tidal, I think I'm mispronouncing her last name, maybe even her first name at the Parabola
Parabola.
Center.
Has done
a really good job of articulating foreseen issues with federal legalization. And while I disagree with her on a lot of points and the virtual signaling in some of her proposals, like a lifetime ban for anybody who's ever been convicted of an environmental crime related to growing cannabis. Like, hello, who do you think are the most likely to get that conviction? A brown person in California. And now you're going to lifetime ban them? Stop the cap, okay? So there's lots of places where I disagree with her. But what she has talked about for many years is how are we going to give social equity operators, legacy communities, a head start when federal legalization occurs or descheduling allows for a different paradigm. And so I don't think that's going to happen because I think there are going to be interests that want to see this happen and know that it's going to take a long time to happen and don't want to wait. And the argument is going to become, wait, we've been waiting a long time. Let's get this right. And the other counter argument is going to be like, yeah, we'll bulk that on later. And by the way, none of those programs seem to be providing the expected or desired outcomes anyway. So now why are we going to hold up the train? And so I'm half optimist. You know, you can call me a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I'm half pragmatic. And I'm like, look, as much as I think that the cannabis industry can be a change agent for other issues and societal conditions outside of cannabis, we still live in a capitalistic society that doesn't place value on things that as a society, we would like to see a higher value placed on, like equal opportunity, like sustainable businesses, like healthcare for even the lowest employee on the org chart. You know, bud tenders are still not getting paid much. Taxes are still draining this industry. We add in federal legalization. You know, there's going to be an excise tax. You know, they're going to want their little piece. They're going to pay for that bureaucracy. We're going to have a whole nother level of bureaucracy. And so I don't expect that it's going to be smooth. I don't expect it to be efficient. I don't expect it to prioritize social equity. I don't expect it to provide a head start for communities that really were at the forefront of the industry when it was legacy and medical. I expect it to be FUBAR, fucked up beyond recognition. But within that, there is opportunity. And so I think about the phoenix rising from the ashes. I think about the fact that more wealth is created in a downturn than an upturn. I think about the complications and the missteps and the failed rollouts as opportunities for the nimble, the adaptable, the bright, the over-informed, and those that build their businesses around a defensive model that they expect things to go wrong. And so I think that the people who do that can really navigate what I would expect is going to be a lot of turbulence and uncertainty and missed deadlines and navigate that in a way that they build all of that into their model. We expected FUBAR. We navigated FUBAR. We expected delays. We navigated delays. We expected that even if they tokenize some sort of federal social equity program, that it's not going to work the way they say it's going to work, that it's not going to provide the benefits that they say it's going to provide. And we didn't buy into the hype of creating businesses that are going to create intergenerational wealth. We bought into the idea that we're going to create businesses that can pay their employees, that can pay their founders, that can get a group health plan, and that can navigate the chaos. And I think in the chaos, there's opportunity, and there's going to be those that get in and get slammed against the rocks. There are going to be those that get in and navigate through those boulders. And then there's going to be those that continue to wait on the sidelines for a measure of certainty this industry has of yet not provided. And they're going to say, we're going to wait until it normalizes and settles in, normalizes and settles in. And that could be 7 to 10 years from now. In the meantime, I still think there's a lot of opportunity, new markets, new states coming online, new new states that are medical going to adult use. And I think, I don't think it's for the faint of heart, but those who do the best already have a lot of heart in this industry.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that it has never been for the faint, right? whether we're talking legacy or regulated, right? Like, there has always been that element there of, having to be resourceful and figure out, how to make a way out of no way and figure out, like, what's going to work best for you. I think specifically, though, just on this rescheduling piece, here's where I'm at. I am all about forward movement. Would I have loved to see it totally, the plant totally descheduled? Of course. Ultimately, I want the plant freed. I want people freed. I hate the fact that there are still people paying with their life while people are making money, because as you said, we're in a capitalist society, right? And so, like, cash rules everything around us, right? So I hate that people are still paying for something that others are profiting from. At the same token, and being a realist, with the way things are going in our nation's capital, in DC, our congressional leaders, people who are, like, struggling to just pass a budget, in terms of right now, did not see a pathway for descheduling. And I also wonder if we are ready for that, because to your point, there is not one state we can point to say, oh, they've gotten equity right. They've gotten their regulated space, right, in terms of it being equitable, right? And so we need that. Like, I feel like the energy has to be on how do we have as many best practices as possible, so that when things totally open up at the federal level, that, we have some language we can push forward. We know the federal government is going to want their piece of the pie. If you look at language that was proposed in CAOA by Booker, Schumer, and Wyden, they had taxes going up to 25%. Okay. And so, I've said this somewhere else. I'll say it here. I'm looking at this as if it was football. I'm looking at, sometimes you get a Hail Mary and you can run that joint in and touchdown. Okay, cool. Other times, what happens? For the majority of the time, what happens? We have first downs. And so we have to keep moving.
Yeah,
the
no, we can get 10 yards and get a first down out of this. And when you talk about Booker and Schumer and their proposed tax rates, if that doesn't give people heartburn, I don't know what would. And those are people who arguably are allies to the industry, who are favorable to the cause. And those that are allies and favorable in a position of power to create policy are still talking about tax rates that we in the industry know are going to be a gift for the trap, that right. are not sustainable, and right. where we are not aligning this industry with a bipartisan mindset, right? Yeah. And so, and I will just dive into politics for a second. As somebody who has voted blue, as somebody who is on some other political news shows where I act as a pundit, there are centrists and people on the right who argue for less government and less taxes. And if we want to make those people and those constituents and those that see the world through those lenses, if we want to co-opt them and make them allies for advancing and growing this as an industry, then those people are not going to receive well models that are based on taxes that in any other industry would be considered government overreach in a way that is borderline criminal. On the other side of the aisle, those of us who want to see good programs come out of government funding also need to understand that we have been tricked into agreeing to these massive taxes because of what those taxes were supposed to do. Oh, That money is going to go to orphans with a cleft palate. That money is going to go to single mothers who are abused. That money is going to go into libraries. And so they come up with all of the important social causes that deserve funding anyway. And then they attach it to the cannabis industry and say, well, what do you got against orphans with cleft palates and single mothers? You're like, oh, I got nothing. Great. Well, then you'll agree to this tax structure. And the next thing you know, the regulated industry has created conflict with causes that are important to most of us, most Americans, and certainly people who want to see the world look better tomorrow than it was yesterday. And where we're saying, well, we need tax reform. And they're like, but you're taking it out of the mouths of these great programs, or now you're not going to have that expanded access to library hours. And so when the government on a federal level is proposing taxes, they're going to allocate it to noble causes, and it will create the same issues that it has created on a state and local level, none of which we can argue or point to tangible evidence is working both for those programs as well as for the industry.
Well, and that's the trick bag, right? That's the trick bag, because I remember when a lot of this was first starting. I remember at a moment of uptick, it was around COVID. And so we saw an uptick of states choosing to regulate because their coffers were decimated, right? And then we're seeing this language come out. And I remember my first question was, well, what happened to funds from the federal level that had been for years, billions of dollars of funds that had been allocated to policing and to public safety, right? So this idea of not having the money, people needing the money, and to your point about these taxes being attached to these noble causes, like getting as specific as cleft palates here, okay? You know what I mean? I had to chuckle. But it's like, well, what happened to the money that you all had to pour into these police precincts where they had fucking SWAT teams, you know what I mean? And where they were, you know, souping up as if it was World War III around this joint, you know what I mean? Like, where's that money? So when we're talking about this stuff, it's a redirection, right? Because no one is really asking about, like, well, if y'all are saying that there's no longer this war on drugs, right? Which, let's be clear, it was very successful. It wasn't failed. It was successful. It did what it was intended to do. But if that is no longer, and if we go back through budgets and we see the funding that was allocated to fight this war on drugs, what I'm asking for is a reallocation. If you were able to find that damn money, then you need to find it again so that it can actually go to the programs, so that what we're doing is setting this industry up for success. Because what we know is that the legacy market still outperforms the regulated space 3 to 4 times the amount. And why is that? Because one, legacy already had great client customer relations, right? People know they weed man. People respect their weed man. All of this stuff that you see in the news that's attached to people having adverse reactions or adverse experiences with cannabis is used because it was laced with something, or it's in the regulated space. We have like Delta 8, or we have, you know, fentanyl being added. People are not properly testing, so you have mold and contaminants. But traditionally, people have great relationships with their weed man, and their weed man knows I got to give them quality shit, because if I don't, they're going to talk bad about it. My name is going to be dirt in the streets and I'm losing business, right? So there was a different kind of client relationship right there. And so it's already outperforming. And so when you look at the regulated space and you look at compliance and you look at, you know, the overhead costs and you look at these taxes, essentially what they're doing to me is setting this whole thing up to recriminalize folks and recriminalize the plant, because you're not creating a regulated space that is, one, ripe and incentivized for people to transition from legacy, and also that is sustainable. Because How are you? I mean, even as consumers, it's like, am I really paying $100 for an eighth? Like, is that really what's going to happen here? You know what I mean? So you're really not even setting the industry up for success.
So two things come to mind for me when I hear you say that.
Okay.
The first is when you say, why are we not taking the previous dollars that were allocated towards cannabis enforcement and redirecting those? My response to you would be that because you are only looking at the dollars that were allocated towards enforcement, you might be overlooking that that previous enforcement was actually a revenue producing activity and not a cost. And what I mean by that is that the cost of the SWAT team, and let me just raise my hand and say on this show, I've been swatted. Okay. If you haven't been swatted, you do not know what it is like to open the door in a towel with water dripping off your hair. And now you got five AR-15s pointed at your chest. It is not
For real.
a very comfortable experience, whether you are in a towel or you are not in a towel. I have to say, not highlight film from my life. But you're looking at the cost of enforcement and saying, can't we reallocate that? I would invite you to look at enforcement instead through a different lens, which is that it was a revenue producing activity. Asset forfeiture was a net positive. You could
Gotcha.
go in, oh, you can't show how you paid for that boat. Oh, I don't know if it's because you're a stoner and you didn't save the receipt when you bought it off Craigslist, or it's because you paid in cash and that cash you can't track back to your bank account, non-source, non-season, non-trackable funds. We'll take that boat. Thank you very much. So there was a revenue producing activity. The second is if we silo law enforcement instead of looking at the prison industrial complex, we don't see the other places where that becomes yet again a revenue producing activity. Oh, you got to go to probation. Oh, you got to pay fees. Oh, you got to go to diversion. Oh, you got to go to residential treatment. Oh, you got to pay victims restitution, whether there's a restitution, whether there's a victim or not. And so all of those things create these opportunities through death with a thousand cuts to realize revenue and fees and taxes and permit and license and this. Oh, you are a cannabis felon. Now you have to register and go get a card in the county that you live in. And so all of those things tended to not, in my opinion, be a cost, but to actually be a source of revenue. And then in areas where I've grown up, like the Emerald Triangle, you have, as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, attorneys like Omar Figueroa suing the Roanoke Park Police Department under the RICO Act because their officers without uniforms were driving up and down Highway 101, taking people's cannabis, not charging them, not handing them a receipt, and not necessarily checking it into the evidence locker with a high degree of specificity. Now, that is not to say that every law enforcement officer is dirty. That is not to say that everybody who worked for the Roanoke Park Police Department is dirty, but it is to say that they turned their eye and said, I see nothing here. Why was Roanoke Park the second highest in terms of asset forfeiture, where they split that pot with the district attorney's office and where these law enforcement staff, this employee, they were out of their jurisdiction, out of their county, and pillaging the industry like state-sanctioned pirates. And so all of that, and then they get new equipment, they get new funding, they get the new door-busting ATV machine. And so there's been this militarization of law enforcement where they have gotten either used or not used, but surplus equipment from the military that has been funneled into local jurisdictions, which has created value with the equipment, the training, the support. And so all of that has really made it a revenue positive exercise. And so when you take that away, it's not that there's funding left over. It's that they're going, where's our piece of the new pie? And so a lot of times these programs have been stood up because law enforcement has received a portion of the tax revenue from regulated cannabis. But here's the problem. The problem is that my local police department that is dealing with break-ins at industrial cannabis locations isn't getting a piece of that tax revenue commensurate with the number of cannabis businesses in their market. Santa Rosa Police doesn't get tax revenue based on the number of regulated cannabis businesses they need to keep safe. And that goes to the state level, and there's no transparency for them about how much actually filters down. Like, you collected this much taxes in your market and you get a proportional amount to keep that nascent industry safe and to actually serve that. None of that is happening. None of that is happening. And so not only are they losing out on the revenue producing activity in the past, but they're not even proportionately sharing in the revenue from the taxes of the industry. If they were, places like Santa Rosa, places like Oakland, certain markets, submarkets in Los Angeles would be getting the lion's share because there are clusters of these regulated cannabis businesses, and that's not how they're treating law enforcement. I thought, how weird would it be that me, with all my experience, would be in a position of actually advocating for the police in my area to get more money from cannabis taxes? But I am, because I think that they are not getting a proportionate amount relative to the businesses that they're tasked with keeping safe from theft and robbery. And
but why is that though, Yaro? Why is that? Why is it? But this is why it is, because these businesses have to operate as cash businesses, which means that they are more of a target for that theft, for that robbery, for those things that you're talking about, which is why more policing is even needed and necessary, in addition to retail spots. In most places, a part of their plan has to be that they are hiring security, right?
I would argue again that it's not because they're cash businesses, because at this point, cannabis banking is a thing, and anybody who wants an account, they've got options. It's not a impossible.
The fees are exorbitant, though. Can we agree to this?
Yeah, the fees are exorbitant, but I would argue it's because this is valuable. And so when you have a small item that's valuable that you can sell on the secondary unregulated market, this is a highly liquidable piece of stolen equipment if you steal something. And so I think that when you're talking about extracts, and you're talking about, you know, grabbing a mason jar of THCA diamonds, like that's a high value, like that's a TV, but you don't have to worry about breaking the TV, and it's not big. And so it's a high value industry to steal from. It's easily liquidable on the black, you know, market, where, and I wouldn't call the unregulated cannabis market the black market, but the black market for stolen goods. And then the other thing is that the industry, I think, has gotten a reputation as being underserved in some markets by law enforcement. And so professional roving bands of thieves, marauders, know that they're not going to be interdicted in the way that they would be if they hit the jewelry store or a 7-Eleven.
Okay, well, look, true to form, you know, when you and I start talking, we go down the rabbit holes and it becomes a whole thing.
Next thing you know, time is out.
That's it. Look, it always happens. I remember one of our first episodes, I think it was like damn near 2 hours. And it was just like, we still didn't get to all the stuff. So look, people, I'm going to get parting words from you, Yaro. But before I do, I really want to say, I always love shooting the shit with you. What's really good? Y'all got to let us know how y'all feel about the title of the segment. We're going to tighten things up. I think the goal is going to be maybe we can get to at least 2 news items per segment, because we really want to have this back and forth. Like, this is the beauty of it. You know what I mean? We really want to have it. I think a number of things have been introduced just in this conversation. So I'll go to you first for a wrap up. So we started out talking about the rescheduling, descheduling. We then got into the prison industrial complex. We then got into funding allocation, the fact that it's a capitalist society, and like, look, they want return on their investment. And so, you know, how are we looking at budgets and allocation? We done went all over the place, right? What do you, I guess, want to just kind of wrap up with 2 or 3 gems that you really want people to take from this conversation?
Well, I would wrap up by looping in that which we did not get to discuss, which is that we were going to talk about the dumpster fire that continues to provide a flame that is almost like the Olympic torch that never goes out, which is the market of New York State. And we were going to talk about that. But instead, we talked about, and spent more time on what is happening on a federal level. And I think that I would just invite the viewers to think about the similarities when we talk about rolling out policy and we talk about making it industry friendly and we talk about prioritizing social equity, that everything that you and I just chopped up here on what's really good and in respects to the federal level and rescheduling and descheduling, a lot of that actually does apply to what we didn't get to talk about in regards to New York. And so I just invite people to think about the similarities, the trends, the groupthink, and the replicated public policy missteps that are occurring in many markets, many states, and that where many of us in the industry who have some experience have real reservations about what that could look like on a federal level and wanting to make sure that there is some application of lessons learned by those who inevitably will set up a group of rules and regulations that we hope will align not only with what we believe to be the core industry values, but also create an industry that'll be exciting to be a part of. And so I would just tell people, like, look, Frederica and I, when Frederica and I are on a roll, we are on a roll because that's what this is about. But tune in again, because we're going to be talking about these things. We're going to be tapping in a little bit more frequently than me, maybe once a year, once every 18 months. And let's talk about what's happening in this industry, what we see right here, right now, what we predict the horizon will look like, and what we've learned from what's in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, absolutely. I would just say you got to tap in, people, because the devil is in the details always. It's always. And if you are not at the table, then you are on the menu. And so as we're looking at stuff, whether it's at a federal level or it's at a state or the local level, you have to make sure that your voice and your experience is included in these efforts to regulate this plant and to normalize it in its place, you know, here in our society, and specifically on rescheduling. You know, look, the public comment period is open. It is open until July 22nd. And so you have an opportunity, you know what I mean, to let the DEA know how you feel, to let them know the things that are of your concern, things that you want to see, all of that, you know, whether it is directly applicable to the 92 pages that they release or not, but it becomes public record, you know? And so we have to make sure that, again, our voice is heard, and that, you know, we ensure that this plant and people are treated right and treated fairly.
And you said something which I think I just want to highlight for the viewers, which is it's not that we need to make sure that our voice is heard. What she said was we need to make sure our voice is heard during the public comment period for what's been published and proposed. And so that's a critical element. If you come in at the tail end to criticize what is, you have little value. If you come in to talk about what's proposed, you are a part of the solution and you're bringing some important points that probably need to be highlighted for those who are ultimately going to make these rules and regs. For me, what I think, just my key takeaway, is that I think the most important thing that's coming up is the relationship between what the final descheduling is or rescheduling is going to look like relative to the next version of the Farm Bill, because I believe there's going to be a big interaction between those two, and it's in understanding how those are going to mesh or not work together that opportunity will create itself, as well as incoherent policy that was a oops, coulda, woulda, shoulda.
That's right. So look, y'all, basically the moral to the story is stay tuned, because Yaro and I, on our next discussion, we will definitely dig into the new amendment that was proposed for the Farm Bill. Look, this New York thing is not going to be cleaned up anytime soon, so we have more than enough time to dig into it and to talk about those similarities that, Yaro, you have put forth. So, hey, y'all, till next time, what's really good? Appreciate y'all. Love y'all for real. And we out.